Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. Just got an article emailed to me. Something wrong with the sound, Kathy. Something terribly wrong. Maybe you can push that. There you go. Thank you. Appreciate it. I don't know what that was, but anyway, let's start again. Good evening, everybody. Malloy here. Welcome to tonight's program. Right before we went on the air, I got an email with a link to a news item from the Guardian of the UK, and I want to share this with you very quickly. Scientists are confronting growing evidence that BP's ruptured well in the Gulf of Mexico is creating oxygen-depleted dead zones where fish and other marine life cannot survive. In two separate research voyages, independent scientists have detected what were described as astonishingly high levels of methane bubbling from the well site, setting off a chain of reactions that suck the oxygen out of the water. In some cases, methane concentrations are 100,000 times normal levels. Other scientists, as well as sport fishermen, are reporting unusual movements of fish, shrimp, crab, and other mammal marine life, including increased shark sightings closer to the Alabama coast. There are already signs fish are being driven from their habitat. It's just astonishing. I mean, the ripple effect, no pun intended, of this thing now is starting to manifest. And I don't know how you react to this, Truth Seeker, but to me, this is the cataclysmic event of our generation, this generation. I don't know. I just don't know how to relate to this. Even without the oil gusher, the Gulf was afflicted by a 6,000 to 7,000 square mile dead zone at the mouth of the Mississippi River, caused by the runoff from animal waste and farm fertilizer in the midsection of this country. But this is not that. This is something, you know, much worse. Methane, 100,000 times normal levels. Wow. And the Republicans all day long have been trying to make excuses and for corporate America at the expense of working class America, middle class America. I'll tell you, if you vote Republican, I've already said, I hope the whole country votes Republican. I hope every single elective office in the nation goes Republican, because then this country will collapse quicker than you can say Great Depression. The battles will begin, and we can cleanse this country and maybe start again. And then I got this, too. This is from Rose in Northern California, who writes... Hello, Mike. I'm so angry with the Republicans for blocking the unemployment and jobs bill for about the 900th time. I know a lot about the unemployed. I volunteer at my church, which has organized a networking group to help people who have lost their jobs. I serve as a mentor and job coach. I cannot tell you the depths of despair I see in people. These are people in their 40s and 50s who are the salt of the earth. They did everything we've been told to do. Some of them have advanced degrees or held jobs for 20 years or more, kept up certifications, volunteered for civic groups and schools, and are the very heart and soul of this country. They are now draining savings and retirement accounts. They're close to the edge. Many can't find jobs, and when they do, it's part-time work, contract work, or commission only. Not enough to get by, so they continue to make cuts and drain their retirement to provide for the family. And yes, it's true, those in their 50s are getting the door slammed in their faces. Heck, how can they work until 70 when no one will hire them at 54? Why don't the senators understand that when we provide someone $600 a month in unemployment, there's a ripple effect? That's economics 101. The out-of-work spend their money, they have to, on rent, groceries, shoes for the kids. The Republicans and corporate criminals hate the American worker. We're the most productive, patriotic, and innovative workers in the world. They don't want us to compete with their cheap labor overseas because they want to keep their dirty boots on our backs. The corporate criminals and their puppets in the Republican Party are the terrorists. They have terrorized the American worker since Reagan. They promulgate hate, fear, and terror. Pitchforks to Wall Street. Rose in Northern California. Well, you know, we've been talking about this for several nights. Hell, I started talking about 3 years ago. Where's the tipping point in the society where we finally realize that that the potential is disappearing, if not gone already? I don't know if people understand there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of jobs that are not coming back. Who doesn't? What is it? I understand denial and avoidance are two great defense mechanisms, but we have millions of jobs that are not coming back, and they're not coming back because of globalization. And globalization is a Republican engineered idea signed by Bill Clinton, who was a Republican. Come on. It just keeps getting more severe and more severe and more severe, doesn't it? Stories of people who are depleting all the resources are rampant. What's going to happen when all the resources are completely depleted? What's going to happen then? What's going to happen when people realize that the Republicans, and for that matter, conservative Democrats, are not going to come to their rescue? Government is not going to come to the rescue, and government could so easily, but it's not going to happen. I heard something on one of the, maybe it was Overman's program tonight, I was kind of half listening, that some Republican freak, I think it was this psychopath who's trying to unseat Harry Reid in Nevada. But the psychopath is saying this is a good thing that all these jobs are gone because it's making American workers more productive. In other words, it's pushing people to the absolute limit that they can possibly stand. And the Republicans are celebrating that. They think that's good. That's good. If it requires a kind of economic or job Darwinism, good. The weak will die. And this is, I've been telling you this. I've been not telling you. I don't want to sound like that. We've been talking about this endlessly, that the Republicans, they want people, they want Jew and Gentile, gay and straight, man and woman, black and white, to go after each other's throats. They want blood in the streets. They want death and destruction. I mean, all you have to do to understand that is to listen to one Glenn Beck program. And again, if he had any decency, he would off himself. Just do it on radio or television, Glenn, so we can all watch. Pigs. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Sharon Angell, the psychopath that is running for Harry Reid's seat in Nevada, you got to hear this. It's posted at Huffington Post. If you've been paying any attention to this crazy woman, you know that she's sick and tired of the long-term unemployed taking home all those cushy unemployment benefits. And what she believes is that millions of Americans are just living large on the dole and need to have their unemployment benefits terminated so they'll be motivated to go out and get a job, right? One of the millions of magical jobs that apparently exist in this crazy broad's mind. Last night, she was on this program face-to-face with Nevada political reporter and host John Ralston. And I want you to hear what she had to say. It starts with Ralston asking her how she would have voted on the bill to extend unemployment benefits.
How would you have voted on that bill to extend unemployment benefits?
I would have voted no, because the truth about it is that they keep extending these unemployment benefits to the point where people are afraid to go out and get a job because the job doesn't pay as much as the unemployment benefit does. And what we really need to do is put people back to work. So if you want to ease people back into work, what we need is an unemployment benefit that pays part. You know, you go to work, you have something of a safety net here in unemployment, but just to give them full unemployment benefits and then extend those for 2 years or more gets them not only out of the working class, but it also depreciates their skills so that they're not really able to go out and compete in that workforce. And so that's what we really want, is we want something that stimulates a group of people to go back into what we know is
that
free market.
You have an interesting view, actually, about jobless benefits. And I want to show people what you had to say in what is now a celebrated interview about jobless benefits. Listen to this.
You can make more money on unemployment than you can going down and getting one of those jobs that is an honest job, but it doesn't pay as much. And so that's what's happened to us, is that we have put in so much entitlement into our government that we really have spoiled our citizenry and said, you don't want the jobs that are available.
So you're saying that these tens of thousands in Nevada, they're sitting on their couches, they're all spoiled, they don't want to go out and get a job, and I'm going to cut off your benefits. That's your attitude for the
toward
these.
Spoiled. Come on, John.
But you said they're spoiled.
Well, I said that it had spoiled our citizenry. That's a little different. They're not spoiled. What has happened is the system of entitlement has caused us to have a spoilage with our ability to go out and get a job.
You think a bunch of people are sitting out there saying, you know what, this is great, I get my unemployment check coming in, I'm not going to go out and look for a job?
No, they're not.
That's what you're implying,
though. It's not what I'm implying.
Okay.
What I'm implying is that there are some jobs out there that are available because they have to enter at a lower grade, and they cannot keep their unemployment.
Are you listening
to
this?
They have to make a choice now. We're making them make a choice between unemployment benefits and going back to work and working up through the ranks of that job and actually building up a good wage again and building up some seniority in that job. And what we need to do is make that unemployment benefit go down, not just completely remove the safety net from them while they go out and go to work.
So you're saying that people lose their job through no fault of their own, as many have during this recession. Mm-hmm. Sharon Angle's solution is to cut their unemployment benefits so low so they're somehow going to go out and find jobs that don't exist. How does that make any sense?
There are jobs that do exist. That's what we're saying, is that there are jobs, but those jobs are entry-level jobs, and they don't pay what the worker can make a living on.
People sitting out there now who don't have jobs to say, I'll take anything. I'll work at McDonald's. I'll go
That's
dig
right.
ditches.
And then we should start to supplement with the unemployment, but just to give them an unemployment benefit and then say, if you get a job, you don't get unemployment anymore. That's really kind of hard scrabble there. It's hard to get your people back into a working situation if they have to make that choice.
And you want to know something? This psychopathic woman is leading Harry Reid in the latest poll. Unbelievable. Her assertion that there's a multitude of jobs available for the unemployed is bat droppings. I mean, what is this woman using for brains? The average unemployment benefit is $290 a week. There are nearly five workers looking for every job available. compared to 1.5 per job opening before the recession began. This is your Republican for you. It'd be one thing if the economy had in fact created all kinds of jobs, even entry-level jobs. Then this crazy broad's grand plan to increase the desperation of the long-term unemployed so that they go after the scraps with renewed vigor might be actionable. Might even be entertaining. I know what we could do. Let's pit the unemployed against each other in thunderdomes, which sounds perfect for Nevada. But as they said at Huffington Post, Angle's just astoundingly out of touch with reality. Oh, my God. Go ahead. Vote Republican. All you Nevadas, get rid of Harry Reid. He's nothing but a wimp. Put this woman in. Let's make her senator. Yeah! She was her.
Truth seekers, it's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
It is 25 before the hour. Kay in Oregon wants to respond to that letter I just read from Rose. Kay writes, Mike, sound like the letter you just read from Rose about the unemployed was describing me. I'm almost 44 years old and have been out of work for over 3 years. I have 3 university degrees, over a dozen years, excellent work experience. I can work in numerous types of work. I'll take part-time, temporary, and or contract work, but nobody will hire me. I keep getting told you're too experienced, you're too educated, etc., etc. I've already drained my savings, liquidated my investments, cashed out what was left of my retirement, and I've been living on the cheap, and I don't even have furniture that I haven't gotten for free or out of dumpsters. I've spent the past few days online filling out and sending in job applications, and now some of them are even asking if I'm over 40. I thought they couldn't ask that. But some of them were government jobs, so I guess as long as they only ask, are you over 40, they can get away with it. I've also read that companies won't even consider an already unemployed person for an interview. They will only consider someone who is already employed. Whiskey Tango Foxtrot? I paid all my bills this morning, and I'm good through the month of July. But after that, I don't know what I am. What good was going to college for 9 years and getting 3 degrees? What good was living cheaply and saving? What good was putting away money in a 401k that shriveled up thanks to the banksters? As when I had to cash it out, I got whammied by the tax penalties for early withdrawal. Nothing like rubbing salt into an open wound. Like your last caller last night mentioned, I'm way beyond hope. After over 3 years of living like this and not seeing any options or hope anytime soon, I'm too distraught to even climb up to a breaking point. The right wing wants people like me dead. Let's just say it out loud. They want us dead. About the only thing that picks me up, even temporarily, is when you go berserk on some right winger that's dumb enough to call in and talk to you. Kay in Oregon. Oy, man, oh man, oh man, oh man. It's just, it's just astonishing. I know I say that all the time, right? There's Christopher Bolin, who has a blog. He says a revolution is brewing in the United States of America. The public discontent surrounding the costly and disastrous wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the BP oil spill, all of this are indications that a revolution is nearing. There are, of course, many other grievances, like the trillion-dollar bailout and taxes. The government lies and cover up about what really happened on 9/11. And he goes on and on. And I can, as you can, I'm sure, give you a sense of what I feel out there in the world, what I feel from surfing the web, what I learn, and just from, you know, doing those things that we all used to think was kind of quaint, you know, when you go to the gas station talking to the guy at the next pump, or when you're standing online to pay your water bill, you know, chatting up the person next to you, or listening, as I did the other day. I went into an auto parts store to buy some fuses for the pickup truck, and just listen to the conversations that go on. There's an air of desperation in this country that's getting out of control, and it's evidenced by the fact that the voices of the psychopaths are getting stronger and stronger. People like Beck, people like this Sharon Angle crazy woman, people like Bachman, all these maniacs, their voices are getting louder and louder and louder. And if the leadership of this country, I'm talking about the Democratic leadership, the Democratic Party, the handful of Democrats who are still capable of doing something, if they don't do something soon in their leadership positions, then I don't have any doubt at all. I don't know when it'll come, but I don't have any doubt that we're going to have a situation in this country that is going to be bloody. It's going to be vicious. It's going to be protracted, and it's going to bring down the entire fabric of the society. I mean, what is there to keep it in check? We used to have kind of a social contract that said, you know, each generation does its part to make things better for the next generation. And there was an expectation of that happening by the younger generation. And everybody seemed to work toward that goal. There was a common goal. I'm not talking about U.S. foreign policy. I'm not talking about what the elites were doing even 50, 60 years ago. Of course they were doing their terrible, dirty, filthy work. But I'm talking about the attitude that was in this country. America used to have a can-do attitude that was channeled into aggression and imperialism. I don't deny that. That part was there, but I'm talking about domestically. And that attitude is completely gone. I mean, the idea of one wage earner in a family going to work in manufacturing in this country and making a paycheck sufficient to the needs of the family, those days, of course, disappeared probably when I was in my 20s or 30s. But I grew up with that, and I think back to what it was like in my neighborhood in a working class city that was nothing more. I mean, the whole function of Toledo, Ohio, was to be a feeder city for Detroit, for the auto industry. That was the only reason we were there in terms of jobs. The main jobs, the jobs that drove the economy of Northwest Ohio. Of course, there were other jobs that came along as a result of those factories, those manufacturing plants that were there to feed into the auto industry. But that disappeared in the 70s. That went right down the commode in the 70s. That's gone. So then it took two people supporting a family. Two people. And, of course, there was a con job that said, well, this is women's liberation. Women's liberation, all that was about was political liberation and sexual revolution, sexual liberation. But for corporate America to grab hold of women's lib and say, well, this is what it is. See, you get to go to work. You get to get out here and get your ass into a factory, too. Now, in the meantime, we're going to cut everybody's wages. So, yeah, come on, girls. Come on in and do what the boys have been doing. Come on. So then it took two family members. And then it became three. In the meantime, the cost of an education is skyrocketing. Inflation was eating up what little bit everybody had. And now we're at this point where we have people who aspire to be senators telling us, or telling the brain dead, that unemployment compensation, unemployment benefits are turning Americans into, I mean, this is the same thing they used to say about welfare, that welfare recipients were somehow scum. They would sit back and suck up their welfare check and suck up their food stamps and drive their Cadillacs to go buy T-bone steaks with the food stamps. That was the story Reagan put out. And I'll be damned if enough white people didn't believe it. If they want, they being the power structure, if corporate America, if capitalist America really wants blood in the streets, they'll have it. It will come. You know it as well as I do. This can't go on. I mean, it can't. And it appears that it is. Somebody tell me something that would indicate otherwise. Somebody send me something. Send me an email. Send me a link. Send me something that says, nah, here's the proof. I'm not talking about your right-wing pigs. You know, I don't even want you to listen to the program. Go away. But any rational people out there, if there's something that you know is going on, and we're not talking about it on this program, that would indicate that we're not spiraling down the drain pipe, well, then will you let me know? Because I look all over trying to find trends, if not proof, at least trends that, you know, to grab hold of. I've got grandchildren like you do. I've got nieces and nephews like you do. I've got a five-year-old like you might. And, you know, I hate to see that generation being given this. Jesus, God, I mean, what did the kids do to deserve this? What have we done? And why do we keep doing it? Why haven't we said enough? Why haven't we reached the tipping point? Does anybody know? Anybody have any ideas? I just feel like sitting here listening to that record. I really do. Reminds me of Tony Soprano. Right? seems like a million years ago. I don't know. I'm getting confused. It's getting harder and harder to separate reality from cinema. Len writes, where's the tipping point? With what America has been through the past 30 years, America is like an abused spouse in a horrible marriage. They know that what they are going through is not right, but it's either accept the abuse or accept the unknown. And the unknown is always the scarier of the two to deal with. Well, I think we're running out of choices. I really do. It must be hell to listen to this program at night for those of you who do, because I can't seem to get off the some of these topics. Like, here's some subject lines: perpetual war, veterans hospital in U.S. has come under fire after revealing it may have exposed more than 1,800 dental care patients to hepatitis and HIV. U.S. banks' role in Mexican drug trade. That's from Bloomberg News. The G8 fully believes, according to Haaretz, that Israel will attack Iran, according to the Italian prime minister. I love this one, though. Australia's new leader is an atheist. Julia Gillard, however you pronounce it, first female prime minister. She's also an out-and-out atheist. Bless her heart. Oh, my God, we need more of that. We'll get to some of this a little bit later. Jay is driving in North Dakota. Hello, Jay.
Hey, Mike. I talked to you a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I was just listening to your show. My biggest thought is I think that the majority of Americans are just very apathetic.
Well, yeah, we've talked about that considerably, this learned helplessness. But I mean, that only lasts so long. I mean, when it gets down to the point of people realizing that their apathy is going to kill them, is going to take their lives and the lives of their children, and further down the line, their homes, their whatever stability they might have. I mean, at some point, the apathy gets overridden with desperation, doesn't it?
I think for a few passionate individuals, it does. I was in a staff meeting a few years back, right around, you know, in the 2000 election. I was enraged by the appointment of that idiot.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there, and one of the RNs I was sitting with, she just goes, well, you know, I just really don't pay attention to that. You know, this is a registered nurse. You need a 4-year degree minimum to become an RN. And she just didn't care. And it seems like that was a real critical point in our history. This is like, that's how far the corporatist could push us. And now we're that proverbial frog in the boiled water, you know? They just keep bringing up the temperature, and, you know, who cares if a few noisemakers get upset? The majority of Americans just don't care, and it's unfortunate.
Well,
maybe I'm just feeling like giving up, because I'm on a plane to Madagascar in 2 days for vacation for a month, so... You know, maybe I won't come back.
Yeah, well, you know? Lucky you, Madagascar. But
wife is from there, so we're
oh, really?
The family.
Really, she's from Madagascar.
Yes, beautiful woman, wonderful. Yes,
I've heard it's a great country. All right, well, listen, have a good time and take care, Jay. Call us when you get back, okay?
Yeah, I'll send you an email. All right, take care, Mike.
Do that. You. All right, appreciate you checking in. Tom in Minnesota, people just seem to be saying, just live with it. This is very discouraging. Well, I hope there is a tipping or trigger point. I just don't think this would happen here in fascist corporate America, because violent revolutions for social change have gone out of style in this sick country. No, Mike, unfortunately, we truth seekers need to head for the exits of this police state. Tom in Minnesota. Well... I guess that's one. Conclusion that is easily enough arrived at, for sure. All right, we have a break coming, so during that break, I'm going to try to get my sense of balance back again. Just a couple of rough spots there at the beginning. I guess what it was seeing the dead and dying dolphins tonight out in the ocean, not up on the shoreline, but dolphins in their death throes, struggling on the surface of the surface of the water to breathe. It's reported by television. I don't know is this more disaster porn? Is this extinction level event porn? I don't know what it is, but to see that and to think, oh my God, I mean, this is happening essentially in the United States, and we're all sitting around not knowing what to do. Nobody knows what to do. How did that happen? How do we get to that? Nobody knows what to do. We'll be back. Seven past the hour. This is the Malloy program. All right, let's go right to your phone calls. Mary Lynn is driving in South Carolina. Welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm driving back to Atlanta. I remember you from the old Atlanta days.
Oh, my goodness.
I was a big fan then.
Uh-huh.
The reason I'm calling is my husband and I are driving back. You know, it's the dead of night here. Well, not quite the dead of night, but I heard you say something that I guess I don't remember from those days. It sounds as if maybe you're even adopting some of the techniques of the other side. It sounds a little inciting. The phrase that you used was blood in the streets, which made me perk up and say, oh, I really don't understand that kind of language, particularly when it comes from the left, because it sounds so inciting and so apocalyptic in a way.
Well, that's about where we are, Mary Lynn. Let me ask you something. Do you have a job?
Yes, I
have. All right, let me just go down the list here. Does your husband have a job?
Yes.
Okay. Let me just go down the list here.
Okay.
Are you comfortably middle class?
We are. Yeah.
Okay.
Not,
all right. Let me just continue here, so
okay,
that you'll understand why I used that term. Now, please keep in mind, I'm not advocating blood in the streets. I'm saying I don't see how we can avoid it. Do you have savings? Do you have investments? Do you have a
401k? No, barely.
But you do. Let me go down the list here. But you do have Do you have health insurance?
No, I don't, actually.
Neither you nor your husband have health insurance?
No, we don't
at
the moment. Yeah.
Do you rent, own your home?
We own our home,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
All right, well, let me ask you something, given my little quiz there. Supposing you were told tomorrow you had to vacate your home because you couldn't make payments anymore, and this came right after you were fired and your husband was fired, and then you found out that what little savings are put back that you had been eaten up by banksters, And then you found out that the vacation trip you were planning to the Gulf of Mexico could not happen now for a number of reasons, not the least of which is there is no more Gulf of Mexico that you can, you know, go enjoy. So let's suppose you lost everything, and then somebody knocked on your door as your the sheriff is there to put your stuff on the street, and they're there to repossess your car. At that point, let me ask you something. What would you do?
I totally understand what you're saying.
Okay. Do you understand this, Mary Lynn, that there are people in this country who have been unemployed now for 2 years? There are people in this country who rely on unemployment compensation checks, which is not tax money, by the way.
And I've been on unemployment myself.
Right. So have I. And they're being told, let me finish the list here. Being told, by Republicans that they can no longer have unemployment compensation, even though there are no more jobs. And if you live, yes. If you live here in Georgia, you know what's happening in Georgia. The school boards are broke. The state government is broke. The Department of Roads are broke. All right. Now, the point I'm trying to get to, Mary Lynn, at what point do you think it would not be tacky to say there's a possibility of blood in the streets? Or do you think we should never say that, even when it happens to be flowing into the gutters?
Blood flowing in the gutters?
When it gets to that point, can we say it then?
Oh, well, of course.
Okay, well, that's pretty much all I wanted to know, because I don't understand how talking about your future, Mary Lynn, and mine, and your children and or grandchildren and mine, when we talk about the future and we have nothing to point them toward, unless we are delusional, which can be fun. It can be very much fun to be delusional. It can be very much fun to live in a state of denial, to avoid some harsh realities. But I don't think saying that unless something happens, there will be blood in the streets, unless you want to become ahistorical and pretend like that never happens, because it's a bit, I think, inciting was your word.
I think she was lamenting the fact that your program is not the same as it was, 20 years ago.
Well, there's a reason for that.
You were on the air here in WSB, and that was prior to, at that point, Bush the first.
Right.
And Bush the second.
And Clinton. And all these filthy Republicans. And Gingrich. And just on and on and on.
All the, especially the last 8 years, all the damage, all the wars, all the blood. And if not blood in our streets yet, Mary, there was blood in New York. And there's blood all over Afghanistan's streets. There's blood all over Iraqi's streets that's flowing. And that may not be a real pretty picture to think about. But it's out there and it's real. And we caused it. And it's hard to ignore that it's happening. And it's not uncommon to believe or unheard of or out of the question to consider that some sort of armed revolution would happen in this country if finally the middle class is beaten down to the point where there isn't such an animal.
And I'll tell you what's inciting to anyone who cares. What's inciting is being told that there's no light at the end of the tunnel, not even an onrushing freight train. There is no tunnel. There's nothing. That's inciting when you're being told that not only are you unemployed, but you're never going to get a job again. Or when you are told the way the Sharon Angel doofus in Nevada is telling people, well, you can get a job and then work your way back up again, to people who are in their 50s and 40s who have busted their asses trying to work themselves up the economic ladder and then have it all disappear. And then you have some freak like Sharon Angle say, well, there's jobs out there, but you know, unemployment is going to make people lazy. And then you have some monster like the senator from Kentucky, Jim Bunning, say, no, I've got a basketball game to go to. I'm not going to stay here and vote for more unemployment for these poor bastards out there in the street. Now, I'll tell you what, you want some inciting words? Don't listen to this program. Listen to Limbaugh. Listen to Beck. Listen to the Republicans in the House and the Senate. Listen to the military people who own the country. Listen to corporate America. And if those words aren't inciting, immediately drive yourself to the nearest emergency room because you are slipping into a coma and you may die. Inciting?
20 years ago, the biggest thing we had to worry about was how to spend the surplus.
No, that's not exactly true. In 1990, no, we were coming out of another recession thanks to Pappy Bush and Reagan. Clinton was about to put into play his tax increases that the Republicans all wet their pants and screamed about, but resulted in, well, what it resulted in when Clinton left office. Surpluses, budget surpluses, as far as the eye could see, and a paying down of the national debt, which I believe when Clinton left office was what, $6-7 trillion? What is it now? So no, 20 years ago, we were trying to get out of another Bush bastard's recession. So let's take a break. We'll come back and take some more phone calls. You know, I'm not trying to dump on the person who called. I just find it astonishing as to what is considered inciting or what is considered unacceptable language on the radio. I get it all the time. Clean up your language. Because I use an SOB or a GD once in a while, because it just totally blows me away. And I don't use language you can't hear outside your church every Sunday morning. Never mind. We'll be right back. Heard them all, but love's the only engine of survival. Your servant here, he has been told to say it clear, to say it cold. It's over, it ain't going any further. And now the wheels of heaven stop. You feel the devil's riding crop. Get ready for the future, it is murder. Tangled power slide, in all direction, won't be nothing. The hour. John is in Lompoc, California.
Oh, hi. How you doing, Mike?
All right, John. How are you?
Good. Insightful. That was an interesting call you just had.
Yeah.
I called you a couple of years ago, or maybe 5 years ago. I was in Kadena in Okinawa, and I was telling you how one of my Army neighbors living on the base was teaching people in the Philippines how to build roadside bombs, and then...
Oh, yeah.
Remember that call? Well, anyway, I've transitioned out of that, the Air Force. I've retired. Now I'm working as a contractor on an Air Force base here in California. And something astonishing is happening. They're converting us to civil servants by the thousands.
So, civil servants?
Yes, GS employees.
Yeah.
And but the thing about it is, a lot of us are taking going to have to take 30-45% pay cuts. You know, we're all right now, we belong to a union. We're all in union. And we we get really good health care from them. Plus, I got my TRICARE from the military retirement.
Mm-hmm.
But when we go into the civil service, the people without any retirement, they're going to have to pay for their own health insurance. The government service now does not pay for that. It comes out of your paycheck.
Well, why is this? Why are you being converted to civil service?
They say they're going to save money. You know, it sounds good. You know, I could take a 10-15% pay cut. You know, maybe even 20. I could stop it. I could accept it. But you know, I think they're just trying to use the last caller. No, not you, but actually you. They're trying to incite people. What are they doing? That they're cutting our pay by 40%, doing the same thing.
Now you, let me get this straight because I may have misheard you at the very beginning. There, you work for who do you work for now?
I'm a contractor. I work for.
Now you don't have to name the company, but you work for a private business or a military contractor.
Military contractor. There's on the base. There's a base supply.
I got you.
And they contract that function out.
And your paycheck now comes from a private company.
Yes. And of course, the government pays the owner of the business.
Right. Okay. I got you. So your company is telling you, or is the government telling you that you're going to be converted?
The government.
The government is saying to your employer, "We want to convert your employees to
they're ending
civil
the
service.
Contract. Yeah, but they are ending the contract. No longer we're going to be working for the government, and we're not going to be paid by the private contractor. You know, it sounds good when on the surface, but here, to me, also it's a type of union busting.
Yeah, just very quickly, we're running out of time. This segment. Why does it sound good to you? I'm curious. What about it is good?
Well, I think, you know, I guess I'm kind of a socialist. I don't mind working for the government. The government has provided well for me in the military. I don't like what they do most of the time, like bombing and killing people.
Right.
But the government can take care of people, and they can take care of people very well if it's done properly and funded.
Mm-hmm.
And the military, of course, is. That's why it sounds good. Yeah, and maybe they're going to hire more employees. That's good too. But for people who are who've been living on a certain wage, and now they're going to take a 40% pay cut, it's just kind of tough to understand why they.
I would imagine there are people who I'm just guessing here. So let me rephrase it. Are there people who work for your company who don't see this as who don't see it as calmly, let's put it that way, as you do.
Actually, we're all so scared. I don't see this as a good change. Don't get me wrong.
I understand that. But you seem able to roll with this particular punch.
Yeah, because I have a retirement income from the Air Force.
Right.
But,
so
no, they're scared like rabbits, Mike. And the union is doing nothing so far, so I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
And people are too scared to talk about it. They just frozen. Oh, we'll just have to wait. I'm talking a lot to people and trying to incite them, you might say. And it's probably. I just think this is another effort too by people to just shake the confidence of the government. I think a lot of people won't be able to continue this work.
Mm-hmm.
They'll go someplace else, and then they'll have to hire new people without any experience, and nobody will know what they're doing.
You know, I doubt that there'll be very many people who will attempt to go someplace else. Someplace where else?
Exactly.
If it's a 30-40% pay cut, that means they still get a paycheck.
In fact, that's what a GS-13 has reportedly said.
All right. Well, John, more great news, I guess. Listen, don't wait another 2 years to call, okay?
Yeah, I have to put this plug in for you. I love your podcast. I listen to them in the morning when I go to the gym. So.
Well, thanks a lot. All right, John. Take care.
You too.
All right.
Bye.
We'll be right back. Thank you.
Standing up to the flying monkey right, it's Mike Malloy.
I ring it in the morning.
It is 25 before the hour. We are not video streaming right now until we get some things squared away here at Malloy Central. Back to your phone calls. Bob is in New York City listening on XM. Bob, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike. I love your show. I listen to you, and we've spoken before.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Now, I worked for New York City Transit, MTA New York City, 30 years. I'm also a licensed ham radio operator. I speak to a lot of people about a lot of different things, and especially what's going on. And it seems to me, from my own findings, that almost 90% of the people that I speak with don't even know the slightest thing of what's happening. I try to listen to the ham radio bands for people that are down in the Gulf, Florida, anywhere in that area. Very little is anything that anybody talking about what's going on. No one seems to know. To me, it seems it's all part of a plan. I mean, how many ships are down there that are being turned away, that want to help out, that want to skim the oil? No one wants them to touch it. The Coast Guard pushes them away. There's gigantic ships that are down in Virginia that can suck up this stuff and like tomorrow, and they're not being allowed. The bottom line, Mike, is that no one or the majority of the people that are out there do not know what's going on.
Yeah. Well, I hear you. And there's no way the majority of people are ever going to be able to understand what's going on. Because the information that you just put out there, who in media puts that out? Who says anything?
Right. I don't trust the media because it's controlled. That's why I don't listen.
Well, yeah, that's the whole point. If we don't have a citizenry that is even to a slight degree informed, I mean, we can be dumber than doornails, which we are in this country, but at least we should have a media that will say to us, okay, here's the truth about what's going on. And we don't have that. I mean, look at the story that, the freelance journalist for Rolling Stone put out there, while every single professional he's a professional, but I mean every single establishment corporate media type reporter wouldn't have touched that story with a 10-foot pole, because they know if they would have reported the way Hastings, the way he did, that they would lose their little privilege of having tea with General McChrystal. You know, how are we supposed to even become partway informed, Rob, if we have a media that is completely useless? Go ahead.
Well, Mike, I'm sorry. The only recommendation I can make to your listeners and to many people out there is to buy a small shortwave receiver and listen. Tune around. There are many stations on shortwave that provide the truth. And it's inexpensive for like $19 or $29 in some local electronics store. You can buy a small portable shortwave receiver, and it's good to have it for an emergency anyway. And if you want the real news, it's on shortwave. Because if the internet goes down, which is what they plan to do, that's all you're going to have left.
Well, okay. All right, Bob, thanks.
All right, Mike, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right, take care. I have a couple of friends that have done just exactly what he's talking about with shortwave radio. The only problem with shortwave, of course, is that, if I understand it right, is that the same? No, I guess that's not the same as ham radio where you talk back and forth. That's something different. All right, never mind. Scratch that. Forget what I was going to say. Bob is in Brunswick, Georgia. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on, Mike.
Sure.
Sticking on that theme with the news, another thing that's unreported is when Rachel Maddow gave that mock speech about what the president should have said, the next day she's called to the White House with two or three more so-called liberal talk show people. In the next show she was on, she wrote that off this big list of accomplishments that he's done. So that tells you where that station, you know, what they've got to put up with.
Let me make sure I understand. Are you suggesting that Rachel Maddow has been sucked into the vortex now and had her mind warped because she got invited to the White House? I heard something about that. I missed it completely, but...
No, I'm not saying it did that, but it kind of put her in check. It was like, I'm sure they gave her, you know, a little lecture or something, because the next program, she ran off a big list of accomplishments.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing you never hear about is the fact that when Israel boarded that ship out there on the open water, that they had an actual hit list with them. They had a list of people to murder. I mean, that you hardly ever hear that anywhere either.
Well, I haven't. What's your source for that?
Well, they had the soldiers they captured. The people had it up showing you the list. And they had it in waterproof with the pictures and everything of the people that... it was like a hit list. You didn't say that?
Well, no. What I'm asking, Bob, and I'm not trying to challenge what you're saying. I'm just curious. Where did you hear this? Because I haven't heard anything about it, and I scour the internet from websites here in this country to the Middle East to South Asia to South America. That's the first I've heard of that. Where did you hear that?
Well, I mean, I saw it on about five or six different sites. I'd be glad to email it to you.
Well, if you would, I would appreciate it because, you know, my feeling about what the Israelis did on that boat, I believe it was murder. But is on the part of the Israeli commandos. But to say that they had a certain hit list, that sounds like something we would do. You know what I'm saying?
Well, it's kind of symbolic, isn't it? I mean, don't we kind of do what Israel wants to do anyway? I mean,
well, in a lot of instances, it seems that way, or vice versa. I don't know. I don't know who is the dog and who is the pony. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I mean, like last night you were talking about a dual citizenship. I mean, where would it stop? Could the president have a dual citizenship? The chief of staff does, you know, and a couple of senators, I think, have the dual citizenship of Israel. I mean,
well, I think,
what if it was another country? Would that be acceptable? What about Palestine or... You know,
I get your point. You know, I get your point. You're kind of preaching to the choir on this one, as you know, if you listen to this program on a regular basis. But I hear you loud and clear. All right. If you can find that source, Bob, send it to me. I'd love to see that. Okay.
I'll do that. Thanks for taking the call, Mike.
You bet. Take care. That's a new one on me. But why would I be surprised? I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, in these times, what the hell are you going to be surprised about? Seriously, what's going to surprise you? You know what would surprise me? What would really be just an ass-kicking surprise for me? It would be to hear Barack Obama come out and go to the Rose Garden and say, because of the situation in reality in Afghanistan and Iraq, I have decided to begin withdrawal of all U.S. forces. And then what also would be a surprise to me would be to hear the president or one of his spokespersons also come out and say something like, look, the economy is tanking. We're losing everything. So here's what we're going to do. And then talk about setting up a WPA-style program to put people to work. That's what would surprise me. Anything else? Yeah, probably not. All right, we're back on video stream now if you want to come back. We just had a moment of weirdness here. I got an email from Sheila in Wichita that said happy birthday, and I was trying to answer her, and I started knocking stuff over. And pulling out wires. I don't know what the hell I'm doing in here. I really don't. This is this is all strange to me. And it's getting stranger by the day. Right? You feel the same way? Nah, not you. David is in Pittsburgh. Hello, David.
Hey.
Hey.
You know, I was calling your athlete there that...
Let me put you on hold, David, because I'm getting every other word that you're saying. I don't know. It's just not coming through if you're on a cell phone. Kathy will pick up and see if she can hear you sounding a little bit different. Just stay on hold, David, until we go through this break. Kathy will pick up and tell you maybe to move to another room. If you can, we could call some people in prison, so there's no, you know, no way they can move to another room. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
With Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. Back to your phone calls. Sean is in Vancouver.
Hey, Mike.
Hi.
Hey, maybe this is old news to you and the rest of the truth seekers out there, but I just learned today that Kagan worked for Goldman Sachs from 2005 to 2008.
Yeah, I don't know what her association was, but yeah, Goldman Sachs. You know, Matt Taibbi, writing at Rolling Stone about a year ago, put it pretty succinctly that Goldman Sachs is like a, I think he was referring to Goldman Sachs, like a vampire squid that has attached itself to the face of humanity and thrusts its blood sucking spine deep into the heart of everything in this country, and is draining it. So
I remember that.
Elena Kagan, or Alina, whatever the hell her name is, working for Goldman Sachs, who in the Obama administration has not worked for Goldman Sachs.
Good point. Good
or,
point.
Or Lehman Brothers, or one of these other predatory bastards. I mean, who?
Wasn't she also under Larry Summers when she was at Harvard, too? Like, those two are pretty chummy, from what I understand. And
yeah,
Larry
Summers, you know, I think Summers was the president of Harvard at the time she was there.
Is there anything that isn't foul and unwholesome that Larry Summers isn't connected to? I mean,
and doesn't smell bad?
Exactly.
I don't know. It's just become a joke. So that all this raises the question then, is Barack Obama a stupid man who allowed himself to be snookered like this? I realize he's young. What is he, 45, 46, 47? Is he young and stupid, or is he part of this whole disgusting situation? Sean, give me an answer. I desperately need answers.
Well, that's just it, Mike. You know, like, I got into this with Hartman the other day. You know, like, Hartman was saying, well, you know, who cares if he's a corporate Democrat? We need these Democrats to appoint Supreme Court justices.
Oh, God, I'm getting tired of hearing that.
Well, yeah, my argument was, what difference does it make what the composition of the Supreme Court is if we have corporate Democrats appointing corporate Democrat judges to the highest court?
I know. You know, I love Tom Hartman like a brother.
Oh, me too.
But by the same token, you know, sometimes your brothers act like a bunch of dumbasses, if you know what I'm talking about, right?
That's right. That's right.
It's weird. You know, I get this argument too. I get emails all the time from people who say, you know, stop advocating that a Republican, power structure take over the country. Because what about the Supreme Court? You know, and I just want to laugh. What about the Supreme Court? What the hell are you talking about?
You know, that makes me wonder, Mike, if these people who are single, they vote on single issues, they're either, you know, and God bless them, I consider them my allies, but people who are, you know, want to protect abortion rights and, you know, various things like that, gay marriage, that's all great, but are these people willing to live in a country where abortion is protected and gay marriage is legal, but everything else is just corporate dominated and we're all slaves to Wall Street? Would that be acceptable to them?
To a lot of people who claim to be Democrats, yes, it would be acceptable. The single, there's
that freaks me out, man. That just totally freaks me out.
Well, when you stop and think about it, there is very little that is more dangerous than a single issue Democrat or Republican, for that matter, although all Republicans are insane. A lot of Democrats are rapidly becoming that way, but these single issue voters are scary as hell. I mean, you know, if you're not right on issue A or B or C, I'm not going to vote for you.
Right.
Well, what about issue B, C, D, E, F, G, H, all the way through the alphabet? I don't care.
B, C, D, F are huge, too, because, you know, there's the big three. There's foreign policy, there's economic policy, and then there's environmental policy.
Right.
And none of those have anything to do with abortion rights or gay marriage.
Right.
You know, I mean, so they're just going to let those three things go, you know, straight to hell? I mean,
I'm lost in a lost world. That's the reason we're playing Moody Blues music again tonight on our streaming.
Well, I'm like you, Mike. Let the Republicans, let them take it. I don't want to see President Palin just like you do, man.
Oh, God, that would just bring it all down. That would be so bloody and horrific that it would all, I don't know, it'd be like an Edgar, it'd be like a Poe poem.
Oh yeah, and I would probably be hurt by that, but I'm willing to go through the agony of a President Palin just to see this status quo destroyed. I don't like being ruled by Goldman Sachs.
I hear you. And people like me and Tom Hartman would probably wind up in a re-education camp someplace. Oh God. All right. Listen, thanks, Sean.
Thanks, Mike.
Call in again when you get a chance, right?
I will.
All right.
Take care.
You too. Let's not forget the Supreme Court. Michael writes, it was H.L. Mencken. This is regarding Sharon Angle, the woman running in Nevada. H.L. Mencken, who said, democracy is the theory that the common people know what they want and deserve to get it, good and hard. It was Eric Hoffer in The True Believer who said approximately that sometimes the force and determination of those who are not thinking and who are out of control is so powerful that the rest of us have to just step aside and get out of the way before we're run over and we just wait for the crap to blow over. Mencken lived in the time of Warren G. Harding. Mencken regularly ate Harding for lunch and then wrote acerbic columns about the indigestion that gave him. Eric Hoffer lived through a time when it was feared that the true believers might take over the world. Both of them knew that democracy could be subverted by propaganda, by distortion, by government, by public stupidity, furthered by press stupidity and deference to authority. We don't learn from history or even remember it. It's our particular failing. History is boring. Those few of us who remember how BP asked America and its CIA to destroy democracy in Iran in 1953 for the sake of profit not only understand why that corporation will not take full responsibility for the destruction of the Gulf and why it and America are still trying to regain control over Iran by war. We also understand why that corporation will go on spoiling our land, our water, our economy, and our pride for profit. We're in the midst of a kind of national insanity. Others in the past have warned us of the ways by which we might identify and isolate that insanity, and yet we still don't listen. We'll be back. Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. This is the Molloy Show. All right, I'm getting all kinds of emails from people who are verifying what a caller from Brunswick said about the Israelis having a pre-planned hit list and photographs. And not the least of the sources is Amy Goodman. Joe in Cleveland writes, the week of the interdiction of the flotilla, or the following week, Amy Goodman reported that these lists were found on some of the commandos that were taken prisoner, along with photos of those targeted. In any case, this was not reported until several days after the event, and a day or so after some of those were released by the Israelis. Yada, yada, yada. Thanks, Joe. Joe is only one of several who have let me know that Democracy Now! Reported this. And Turkish sources reported it, and I'm surprised that Haaretz hasn't reported it. The Jerusalem Post is reporting the IDF tried to assassinate the leader of the northern branch of the Islamic movement, Sheikh Raed Salah. An IDF hit list of 16 activists to be assassinated fell from the pocket of an Israeli commando during the boarding of that ship, the flotilla. That's according to Jerusalem Post. So on this particular issue, your humble and obedient servant is getting the information way, way, way late. So about nine sources now have come across. All right. And I tend to believe pretty much anything, this is risky, anything that Amy Goodman puts on Democracy Now! So, regarding inciting, this is from Dick, writes, Mike, I share your frustration with those who say that you are too inciting. If I may, let me try to analyze how this comes to be. Liberals are very nice, forgiving, accommodating, and ready to come to win-win conclusions. Liberals have not learned that if you come to a negotiation with Republicans or conservatives or pieces of filth, however one might describe them, if you come to a negotiation with these people in possession of 10 origins with the intent of sharing, you don't start by offering them 5. If you do, you'll be lucky to end up with 1 section of 1 orange. The liberals need to learn, or the liberal needs to learn, that you negotiate with these bastards by saying, these are my blankety-blank oranges. What are you going to offer me so that you might be worthy of sharing some of them? Once I see your offer, I, not you, will decide how many oranges your offer's worth. The only way to get to the point that negotiations with these bastards can be successful is to be at least as confrontational as my friend Mike Molloy is. There's no question that the pieces of filth, okay, I chose my own description, will be confrontational with absolutely no reason or impetus, so their posture must be expected and countered at the onset. Dick. Yeah, that's true. I get so tired. I'm so sick. I guess he stopped it. I hope he stopped it. Of Barack Obama talking about, you know, reaching across the aisle. I've said before, the only time I would reach across the aisle to Republicans is if I were able to hand them a grenade with the pin pulled. Reach across the aisle to these scum? To these pigs? Oh, my God. Barack Obama's accommodating nature, about bipartisanship. You know, what cracks me up is Democratic leaders in the Senate will say, they reached bipartisan consensus, and so will Obama. If they get one Republican senator, like Scott Brown, say, from Massachusetts, who keeps sticking his finger into the eye of the teabaggers that elected him, if they get one Republican to vote with them, oh, it's bipartisan! Over in the House, it's damn near the same way. You know, how many Republican members of the House are there? A couple of hundred? If one of them votes with the Democrats, it's usually what happens in the House that makes it bipartisan is when something is defeated and you find 15 of these filthy Democrats voted with the Republicans. So, whatever. Whatever. And there's something else here I want to share with you. Lawrence Solomon, writing for the Financial Post, Saturday. Now, I understand Financial Post, I think it's part of National Post in Canada, and I've had Canadians tell me that's just a right-wing rag. But Lawrence Solomon is writing about what he captions an avertible catastrophe. He says, some are attuned to the possibility of looming catastrophe and know how to head it off. Others are prepared for risk and even others are unprepared for risk and even unable to get their priorities straight when risk turns to reality. The Dutch fall into the first group. 3 days after the BP oil spill in the Gulf, the Netherlands offered the U.S. government ships equipped to handle a major spill, one much larger than the BP spill that then appeared to be underway. Weerd Koops, the chairman of Spill Response Group Holland, told Radio Netherlands Worldwide, quote, our system can handle 400 cubic meters per hour, which would give each of these Dutch ships more cleanup capacity than all the ships that the United States was then employing in the Gulf to combat the spill. To protect against the possibility that its equipment wouldn't capture all the oil gushing from the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, the Dutch also offered to prepare for the U.S. a contingency plan to protect Louisiana's marshlands with sand barriers. One Dutch research institute specializing in deltas, coastal areas, and rivers, in fact, developed a strategy to begin building 60-mile-long sand dikes within 3 weeks. The Dutch know how to handle maritime emergencies. In the event of an oil spill, the Netherlands government, which owns its own ships and high-tech skimmers, gives an oil company 12 hours to demonstrate it has the spill in hand. If the company shows signs of unpreparedness, the government dispatches its own ships at the oil company's expense. Geert Visser, the Dutch consul general in Houston, said, quote, if there's a country that's experienced with building dikes and managing water, it's the Netherlands, end quote. In sharp contrast to Dutch preparedness before the fact and the Dutch instinct to dive into action once an emergency becomes apparent, witness the American reaction to the Dutch offer to help. The U.S. government responded with, thanks, but no thanks, said the Dutch consul general in Houston. Despite BP's desire to bring in the Dutch equipment and despite the no-lose nature of the Dutch offer, the Dutch government offered the use of its equipment at no charge. Even after the U.S. refused, the Dutch kept their vessels on standby, hoping the Americans would come round. By May 5th, the U.S. had not come round. To the contrary, the U.S. had also turned down offers of help from 12 other governments, most of them with superior expertise and equipment, unlike the U.S. Europe has robust fleets of oil spill response vessels that sail circles around their makeshift U.S. counterparts. Why does neither the U.S. government nor U.S. energy companies have on hand the cleanup technology available in Europe? Ironically, the superior European technology runs afoul of U.S. environmental rules. Jesus. The voracious Dutch vessels, for example. Where was I? The voracious Dutch vessels continuously suck up vast quantities of oily water, extract most of the oil, and then spit overboard vast quantities of nearly oil-free water. Nearly oil-free isn't good enough for the U.S. regulators, who have a standard of 15 parts per million. If water isn't at least 99.9985% pure, it may not be returned to the Gulf of Mexico. More on this when we come back. I don't know. If you live in Canada, tell me that the Financial Post is not just another right-wing propaganda machine, because I don't know anything about it. We'll be right back. Get our hands on that greasy, slimy stuff. For the love of oil, we lost 4,000 people. For the love of oil, how many more will die? Tears I've had to cry for these.
Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. All right, I got an email here from Mike in Golden, Colorado regarding what I was reading from Lawrence Solomon in the Financial Post. Mike writes, Mike, why are you quoting some right-wing rag? This is obviously a pack of lies or half-truths at best. The bit about how the reason we refuse to help is because it violates EPA regs is a dead giveaway. That's a right-wing meme. The oil spill is caused or made worse by environmental regulations. Sarah Palin was citing this crap about refusing help from the Dutch on Fox. Okay, well, I asked for somebody to tell me if this was garbage, and somebody has. I don't know anymore. Honest to God, I have no idea. Does anybody else? I mean, where do you find the truth? Where do you find the truth? I guess you have to go to Hartman's program or Amy Goodman. That's about the only place I can think of. Maybe those two programs. You think? Kathy, what do you think? Hartman or Amy Goodman? Or maybe both of them. Bruce writes, EPA gave BP a waiver to use Kevin Costner's centrifuges, and they returned less than pure water to the Gulf. Yeah, well, I get it, and I get what Mike in Golden, Colorado was writing, but what about at the very beginning when this thing was first happening? I don't know if that statement was true. I do know this, that Piyush Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, who wanted to build some barricades, barricades, whatever the hell you call them, was denied permission because of environmental regulations. You know, the whole environment of Louisiana is going straight into the depths of hell, and Piyush Jindal has to deal with government regulations that all of a sudden are stupid! That's not a right-wing meme. That happened. So I don't even know anymore. And sometimes, you know, I just figure don't even try to find out any truth. It doesn't exist anymore. It's all hog snot, every bit of it. I'm sorry. I lost my mind there for a minute. Paul writes, Mike, you outline and describe well the economically dysfunctional basket case that our country's becoming. People are aware of their personal desperation and the desperation of others. This, however, does not translate to revolution. Revolution requires an organizational framework. The American Revolution was made possible by the existence of provincial militias. These gave the colonists an organizational framework as well as some military experience, examples of how to organize a fighting force, and a conception of how to proceed. Out of this, George Washington was able to create the Continental Army, which over time was able to defeat the British. Similarly, in the Civil War, the militias of the southern states formed the organizational framework out of which the Confederate Army was formed. The gray color associated with the rebels came from the gray uniforms of the Virginia State Militia. The Bolshevik Revolution happened because the Bolsheviks had organized within the Russian Imperial Armies such that these troops were primed for mutiny and able to create and function based on their existing military organization. Many years ago, the noted organizer Saul Alinsky spoke at our college. At one point, one of the campus radicals got up and said something like, "When things get bad enough, the masses rise up and revolt." Alinsky just looked at him and said, "They do?" His point was that this stuff doesn't just happen. You have to get it organized. Unfortunately, history shows us that when bourgeois democratic nations deteriorate, they turn to fascism. Perhaps we will be different. The German example may not apply, as Germany was not a mature functioning democracy prior to the Nazis coming to power. In my opinion, sadly, what is more likely to happen is that as individuals go over the edge, they may lash out at other unfortunate individuals, or even more likely, they will sink into lethargic despair as they give up hope. How much better it would be if we could get it organized to press for specific objectives, political and otherwise, on the model of Martin Luther King and the Montgomery bus boycott and the ensuing civil rights movement. Unfortunately, the despair that those of us who have a clue feel makes this much more difficult. Paul. Well, those are excellent points, but I think, you know, maybe revolution, you know, I guess I've danced around that issue, but I'm talking more like devolution or chaos. When I talk about blood in the streets. I don't think. Well, like the other night, I was referring to the Jacobins and what happened in France after their revolution. How it became a reign of terror. It went on for what, 2 years. Everybody, not everybody, thousands of people felt the blade. There were more heads being lopped off in an afternoon in Paris in 1791 or 1790 or whenever it was, than executions in this country by the British against the American revolutionaries. So the thing that is worrisome to me is not necessarily what Paul's referring to here, an organized response to the kind of madness that seems to be enveloping this country, but the chaos that comes when the systems break down, when all the systems break down, when delivery systems, economic systems, medical systems, government systems, when everything breaks down, what the hell are people going to do? Probably not get organized and put on their uniforms and get involved in a revolution. I agree. It might be much worse than that.
I want to live in a country that's safe, in a land that's clean and free, for every color and culture, every person, every belief. Your greed, your fear, and your lies ain't gonna push me around. I'm gonna use the power I have. I'm
oh, yeah. Oops. Oh, hello. I didn't know my mic was open. That gets me in a lot of trouble, doesn't it?
Time to practice your synchronized screaming. It's Mike Malloy.
We should develop some sort of hand signal, Madam Producer, where you can let me know that the mic is open. Like maybe something like this. Like that, yeah.
Yeah, I got a hand signal for you. Here's the hint, babe. Anytime you hear the music,
yeah,
assume it's open.
Okay. Don in Baltimore writes, Mike, I lived through the riots of 1968, and yes, there can be violence and blood running through the streets. People were deadly afraid. Some were sitting on their porches with shotguns in their hands. Everybody was scared we were going to have a race war. We have a drug culture in every city today, and blood is being spilled. We had about 10 shootings in Baltimore over the weekend. There is blood in the street. You're pointing out the desperate people who can't find work will do desperate things is not inciting people to violence. It's trying to wake people up that this country is heading in a bad direction. And if it continues, things will get worse. Yeah, I'm certainly not an alarmist, and there are very few things that really scare me. And I'm not saying that in a bravado kind of way. Christ, I'm too old to be afraid of things. Really, I mean, you understand what I'm saying. You probably feel the same way. So the feelings that I have right now are not really fear. They're more like just horrific concern. Maybe that is fear about what, you know, how to pull back from all this madness. If you turn on any kind of television, read any, listen to any kind of radio during the day, all you hear are these right-wing demons from hell who are just pushing and pushing and pushing. I said before, Glenn Beck, his type, and Hannity, a little wimp like Hannity, they want to see people, they want to see the blood in the streets. They love it. They want to see violence and rioting and call out the troops because they feel so above it. They incite this kind of stuff. So when I say that Beck, if he does kill himself, like so many members of his family already have, please do it so everyone knows that your ass is dead. I mean, that's all. It's very simple. Some freak writing in the Washington Post today had an op-ed piece that mentioned my saying that. And I think the freak who wrote the op-ed piece in the Post used to work for Bush. Anybody in the Bush administration who has the temerity or the bravado, that's the second time I've used that word in a minute and a half, to say that I And in that group of freaks who use violent language, they've got to be kidding me. I mean, they worked for one of the most violent regimes in the history of the American empire. Worked for Bush and Cheney with all the murder and mayhem. You know, if you get on the air and say the F word or more and more, I hear from program directors that say you can't continue to, you don't even say bastard. And I think to myself, what the hell am I supposed to say? What am I supposed to do? Get on here. I don't have a program like Tom Hartman. Bless his heart. I don't have a program like Bill Press. Bless his heart. I disagree with those guys on a lot of things, but they are much more rational than I am. I am not rational. What the hell are you laughing at?
I was just thinking about what a great promo that would make. I am not rational. I'm your, you know, I'm just waiting for you to say, am I a clown to you? Am I here to make you laugh? Am I amusing?
Well, that's it. I want to be like what's his name in Goodfellas?
Joe Pesci.
Joe Pesci. I want to be that way. I want to come back in after the bar closes, after we close the bar, and just take the schmuck that was standing over there giving me some mouth and do what Pesci did to, what's his name? Just
shoot that poor little kid in the foot. That's what you want to do. That poor little kid from The Sopranos that got strung out on drugs.
No, I'm not that.
I get them all confused.
A Pesci is the one who did that.
Right.
Right. So he...
Turtle or Birdie or whatever his all right. Whatever his
all right.
Name
all right.
Was.
You win. You
butt.
Win. I don't know. I thought I had subdued all this Italian madness that I have to deal with every morning when I get up.
Then he became James Gandolfini's nephew. Hooked on smack. I don't know.
You know, I've said before, I'm not rational. That's why these ridiculous emails and these little creepy bloggers, these right wing bloggers who write about, oh, Malloy said this, Malloy said that. Oh, bite me. You know, I mean, in the first place, I appreciate the publicity, you little geeks, but they don't have the guts, you see, to come right out. And talk about blood in the streets or how much I'd like to just, you know, grab Glenn Beck around part of his private parts like his neck. You know, and give him a great big bear hug, of course. Just give him a big bear hug and just love him back to reality. Yeah, that's what I like to do. Love him back to reality. Yeah, okay. You know what I say about that? That's what I say about that. Oh, my.
Didn't Glenn Beck say he was a clown? That he was just a clown? A sad clown?
Well, no, I don't know why he said that. That's to immunize himself against the charges that he's really, you know, an idiot. Or as we say in the street, an FP. But, I'm sorry. We got all self-involved here. We're not supposed to do that, are we? Greg Patton sent me a link here from, it's at Huffington Post. It's from today. The United States is accepting help from 12 countries and international organizations in dealing with the massive oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The State Department said yesterday, more than 30 countries and international organizations have offered to help. The United States rarely faces a disaster of such magnitude that it requires international aid, but the government did accept assistance after Hurricane Katrina. Most of the countries and groups have offered skimmers, boom, or dispersant chemicals. Well, you know, that's stupid. I mean, that's half-witted. Boom has arrived from Mexico, Norway, and Brazil. Offers have been accepted from six countries, Canada, Mexico, Croatia, Holland, Norway, and Japan. Offers also were accepted from two groups, the International Maritime Organization and the Monitoring and Information Center, which is operated by the European Commission. Mexico, Norway, Holland, Japan are providing skimmers, Canada is providing containment boom, and Croatia is pitching in with technical advice. Well, the point of that Financial Post article, the National Post is garbage, I understand, but the point of that National Post Financial Post article was that early on, when the Dutch offered assistance, the U.S. turned it down. Is that true? Is it not true? I don't know anymore. It seems to me 2 months ago when this first happened, even though BP lied its ass off about what the real implications of this disaster were going to be. And this is why I think they should be tried, convicted, sentenced, and shot. If that's what the crime is, that's what the Chinese do. You do something like embarrass the great Chinese money machine, they'll put your ass up against a wall and the rest of you too, and give you a couple of bullets in the back of the head. And then charge your family for the bullets. The Japanese, when they commit something like this, they also commit ritual suicide. But what do we do in this country? We allow some stinking damn corporation like BP to say, well, you know, we're going to proceed with our little deal up in Alaska. Meanwhile, down in the Gulf, so far, we were right. There's not a single dead walrus. You bastards. Yeah.
Yes, I believe one of our callers had a theory.
Yeah.
On why BP was allowed to get away with what it's getting away with.
Yeah. What?
Brian would like to talk on that very subject.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought you were going to say something. Brian is driving in New Jersey. Hello, Brian. I'm sorry.
Hey.
Yeah.
Wonderful to speak with you, Mike. I'm a first-time listener of yours and a long-time fan of Amy Goodman and folks like that.
Oh, good, good. Well, welcome to this program.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to share an idea.
Okay.
It may sound a little outlandish, and I'm not married to it. I just wanted to share an idea.
Okay.
A couple months back, after the earthquake happened in Haiti, a friend of mine called me up and he said, you know, it's interesting that the U.S. military is kind of taking control of the Haitian crisis and they're denying aid from landing in the country from other countries. Like,
right.
All these planes were landing with aid and different things like that, and they were kind of sending them away, and then, you know, there was just a heavy military presence there.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend noted that on the BP website at that time, there were these advertisements for this new kind of oil exploration that was supposed to be going very, very deep, like deeper than they've ever gone before.
Right.
And there was like a mini commercial on BP's site, and the tagline was, it's seismic, because they were using seismic techniques or something like that. And so my friend at that time suggested that maybe the earthquake was actually
the result
new oil exploration. Yeah.
I would not be surprised. Brian, I'm going to put you on hold for a second. We'll come back and finish this up after I do a break. I would not be surprised if that were the case. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Poor people gonna rise up. Take what's there. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. So many friends.
Ten before the hour. All right, we're talking with Brian in New Jersey, who's suggesting that the earthquake in Haiti might have been triggered by deep well drilling. Well, let me just throw this in, Brian. Our financial affairs advisor to this program, who also is becoming, along with Michael and Roswell, kind of the mechanical or engineering advisors, Bruce writes, no, you can't trigger an earthquake. The energy involved dwarfs the entire megatonnage of all the world's nukes combined. So the point he's trying to make is that drilling in the bottom of the sea like that, according to Bruce, Enberg is not going to trigger an earthquake. So I don't know if, you know, I don't know what Bruce's science background is, but, you know, everything he's written about so far usually works out to be the truth, so.
Yeah, maybe that's the case, yeah.
It is an interesting theory, and I've heard it before. I mean, you know, punching holes in the surface of the Earth 5,000 feet under the sea, you know, who knows what that will do. But, the energy of an earthquake the size of the one that hit Haiti is beyond, pretty much beyond our ability to even comprehend. It's massive, the energy that's released. That's why, you know, obviously it does so much damage, and the damage is so far-reaching. But I don't know. I would say off the top of my head that no, the drilling in the bottom of the ocean did not touch off the earthquake. It's already done enough damage. It's done more damage than you or I or anybody else could possibly have imagined, I guess. Although the idea of drilling in the sea, just to me, it doesn't seem right. Does it, Brian?
Oh, yeah, no. I'm with you. And I think that I'm glad that one of your science friends got to chime in, because I didn't think of that. You know, it's interesting. There's on the National Geographic website, there's an article explaining that earthquake was so intense
mm-hmm.
that the Earth's axis actually shifted.
I heard that. It did something also to the rotation of the Earth. Either slowed it down. I think slowed it down. Either momentarily or forever, some almost immeasurable rate, but it did have that powerful effect on the planet. And I don't think, you know, when you stop and think about it, punching a hole in the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico probably would not cause that.
Right. I agree with that. I mean, my hunch was that maybe it wasn't just drilling that they were up to. Maybe they were actually blowing up rock in order to get at something. I don't know. Like I said, I'm not married to it, but regardless if that's the case, I do think it's fascinating
mm-hmm.
how many countries are being turned away again now with the cleanup. And that's what, it kind of gives me this feeling like, you know, what could it be that they're hiding something down there? And I guess when I was previously thinking of the earthquake theory, you know, I was thinking, well, yeah, maybe if somehow it's possible, and you're
well, I think you know, something. You know, I think the only thing that's being hidden is the fact that corporate America has thoroughly taken over the decision-making process in this country. I think that's the part that media and government are not willing to just come right out and say. But beyond that, you know, I'm not very good at conspiracy theories, except in a couple of instances, the JFK assassination and what really happened on 9/11. But beyond that, hey, listen, I got to leave. There. Brian, thank you. I'm glad you found the program. I hope you call it again. All right? Take care. Nora writes, your language is mild, Mike. We are such milquetoast compared to folks 120 years ago. Your observation that bad times bring blood in the streets is mild stuff. Like Kathy said, bad times like shock and awe already arrived in Iraq and Afghanistan and other targets of the imperialists. It upsets me to hear you berated for these words, especially since I just read about, I haven't read it, but I read about this novel published in 1891 during the Depression that was occurring at that time on the heels of a previous crash in the late 1880s. People were upset, especially this author, Ignatius Donnelly, who wrote the 1891 novel Caesar's Column. Okay, now I'm going to take your word on this, Nora. In the novel, the oligarchy is hunted down in New York City by the Brothers of Destruction, who have taken all they can bear from the exploiting oligarchy. The hunters barricade the Wall Street district and make a giant monument out of concrete, and a quarter million of the oligarchs and their bagmen piled high, thus the title of the book, Caesar's Column. Back then in the 1800s, people were willing to at least imagine a threat to those Wall Streeters who thieve with impunity, work their victims to death, and exploit consistently. Forget the milquetoasts. Cheers, Nora. I haven't heard of that. What, I've never heard of that. What is it? Caesar's Column. Okay, now I'm going to have to check it out. Or Kathy will. Or somebody will. Oh, my God. We never got to Jeff in Sydney, Australia. Jeff, I'm so sorry.
That's okay, Mike.
All right.
Good to talk to you finally after all these years. I'm a first time, long time. Followed you since Air America days. And,
yeah. You're an American expat? You live down there?
Yeah, yes, I am.
Okay.
And I got to say, when I first got onto you on Air America, I thought you were a bit over the top, although I really enjoyed it even at that time.
Yeah.
But now I feel like I'm right with you, my brother. Totally, emotionally.
Yeah,
you really do a service to, well, what's left of democracy.
It's getting harder and harder for me anyway, maybe for you and for a lot of people, to find any kind of so-called balance between two opposing points of view where it concerns what's happening to this country.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to talk about. I've got Huffington Post's front page in front of me right now, and if you scroll down, first of all, there's an alarming headline and a depressing picture of the unemployed people. And then you scroll down, and there's a story about the media and how the right wing dominates, and you don't get to a progressive voice until Olbermann's, who came in at 10th position.
Hey, listen, Jeff, I hate to do this, but I've got 30 seconds, and I got to get out of here. I hope you'll call again. I want to hear what you got to say, but I just can't do it tonight. I apologize for keeping you on the phone that long. I really, 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 really do. All right, we're out of here. Best of tomorrow night. I'm off. It's my birthday. I'll see you Friday. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.
This is an important